40 years ago, in millions of living rooms across the British Isles, a strange alien creature was beamed onto our television screens. With bright red hair and multicoloured spacesuit, his unearthly appearance shocked the nation. But for many teenagers who experienced this televisual visitation, it would change their lives forever.
Starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he blew our minds.
This messianic Martian was with us only for a year, but his impact would be felt for generations to come. Music on planet Earth would never be the same again.
David Bowie as Ziggy Stardust. His most striking feature, shoulder-length orange hair.
Armed with laser-guided melodies and lyrics from another dimension, Ziggy Stardust heralded a new era of rock music.
On stage and walking up a staircase with his band.
Mama, mama, papa, coming for you.
A time of outlandish fashion.
Orange eyeshadow with gold lipstick and a gold disc painted on his forehead.
Outrageous sexuality.
Provocative poses.
And good old-fashioned rock and roll music. So, what made this mysterious extraterrestrial one of the most influential cultural icons of the 20th century?
Now Ziggy play guitar.
This is how Ziggy Stardust blew our minds.
BBC, David Bowie and the Story of Ziggy Stardust. Narrated by Jarvis Cocker.
Yo, it's awful strong, place to love is when it's done. Oh, no, dear. Oh, no, dear. You know why I'm here.
Ziggy Stardust set David Bowie on course to becoming one of the world's most famous pop stars. As the queen of the glam scene, he always seemed a step ahead of everyone else. Where Ziggy walked, others followed. Whether that was his army of screaming fans or copycat artists struggling to keep up.
I've got a clue what to do.
David took it to another level. He just, you know, wiped the floor with everybody. It was game-changing.
When we first saw Bowie as Ziggy Stardust, he looked so complete and so fully formed. It almost was as though he just sort of appeared from a different planet. It was extraordinary. And, of course, at that time, you didn't realise that he'd been trying to be successful for 10 years.
I'm just by nature a very flighty person, but I get turned on and off things all the time very quickly.
Born in 1947, David Robert Jones spent his teenage years trying to make it as a musician.
Davy Jones and the King Bees. Young David.
He went through a series of bands playing R&B and rock and roll before becoming a mod.
A London boy, oh, a London boy.
His belief was that if you want to do something bad enough and you put your mind to it, you can. Trouble is, he didn't just take one thing, he took loads of things. He wanted to do it, be everything.
Age 20, he changed his name from Jones to Bowie and released his first solo album on DRAM Records.
Who's that hiding in the apple tree?
It was a strange mix of music hall and whimsical pop. He even tried his hand at a children's novelty record.
Said the laughing gnome.
I think he was trying on what can I do and what do people want and going through the trial and error period. And there was a lot of error. You know, with a laughing gnome, it's like, okay.
Now, author Dylan Jones.
The Laughing Gnome is not a great record, but it is very indicative of what he was doing at the time because he was obsessed with Anthony Newley.
What kind of fool am I?
Anthony Newley was a giant of British popular culture, as adept as a singer, dancer and entertainer as he was at creating surreal comedy that paved the way for Monty Python and the like.
I think she fancies me.
He was more than meets the eye, Anthony Newley. He wasn't just, what kind of fool am I? Yeah, he wrote that, but there was many other sides to Anthony Newley. Films, the Gurney Slade TV thing, which was groundbreaking when it happened. So I think that's what interested David.
It begs the question, if David Bowie had found success with his Anthony Newley phase, would he have become a light entertainer? But as both the Laughing Gnome and the Dear Em album were the latest in a line of commercial failures, we'll never know. But Newley's quirky versatility would certainly later inform the theatrical DNA of Ziggy Stardust.
I would try and get involved in anything that I felt was a useful tool for an artistic medium. I was trying to be a one-man revolution.
Around the same time the Dear Em album was released, Bowie met Lindsay Kemp, a British dancer who specialised in mime and avant-garde theatre.
I was endeavouring to teach him to astonish a public. I helped him find himself through his movement, so he could express himself so that he had the right kind of control. Being my student, he was so keen. He was like a sponge. I mean, he'd absorb anything that took his interest. Those classes included some mime, but mostly dance. I taught him to dance. Happy
little feet. Within a few weeks of meeting, Kemp and Bowie had created a stage play called Piero in Turquoise, which they toured together around the UK to critical acclaim. Offstage, they embarked on an affair, the choreographer introducing the young singer to London's gay intelligentsia.
He had an enormous sexual appetite, which came across on the stage. I mean, it's a useful thing to have if one has an outlet.
But the dance troupe didn't pay the bills, and nor did his next musical direction, a folk trio called Feathers. Bowie turned to acting to help finance his music, taking small film roles, and even starring in an ice cream ad. And then, seemingly from nowhere, he hit upon a formula to finally launch his music career.
Colour archive film of a rocket launching.
Put out to coincide with the 1969 lunar landings, the single rocketed to number 5 in the UK charts.
Space Oddity, that was a game-changing record, was the record that inspired me to make the Elton John record. As I said, I just want the sound that's on that record because it was so extraordinary.
Although essentially another novelty record, it was also a masterful piece of songwriting. But the songs on the self-titled album, released to cash in on the single's success, sounded nothing like Space Oddity. Bye, bye, pretty girl, I see you see me. The record-buying public couldn't understand what David Bowie was all about.
It was a strange record because at the time he was writing folk songs. His latest thing was having long hair, going on stage, crossing his legs and playing an acoustic guitar. So consequently, he didn't really click again with the public because his image was quite confused.
Bowie had shown the world a glimpse of his extraordinary talent, but it would be 3 years until he could recapture Space Oddity's success with Ziggy Stardust. And as those years rolled by, Bowie became increasingly worried he was damned to be a one-hit wonder.
In 1970, he was fundamentally depressed. He had no idea where he was going. He didn't know how he was going to fit.
A serious change of direction was needed, and that, in part, came from Bowie's bride-to-be, Angie Barnett.
Angela was really a driving force behind David. She was very influential with the costumes. She made him brave. She would have a haircut first if she, you know, she didn't think he would like it. She made him brave.
She was encouraging and always on his side and always positive. She would always encourage dressing him and help the image, and I always found her as a very positive force.
Bowie formed a new band called The Hype, and in February 1970, he unleashed a radical new image.
I was going to do a gig, and Angie said, we're going to dress you all up. And we did the roundhouse. I was supposedly a cowboy man because I had a cowboy hat on and a frilly shirt with some tassels on. We were just thrown together, but David's was like, he had the big knee-high leather boots. And we just did this gig, dressed up, you know, theatre.
Drummer John Cambridge.
The London audience wasn't ready for superheroes playing heavy rock, and the hype bombed. With hindsight, it seems Bowie was just ahead of his time, especially when you consider the hype's makeup and costumes predate Mark Bolan's first glam rock TV appearance by over a year. Bowie's plan to create his famous alter ego was beginning to take shape. The proto-glam band The Hype are most notable because it's the first time David Bowie worked with Mick Ronson, the guitarist who would become part of the sound of Ziggy Stardust. Their first studio collaboration was on Bowie's next album, the heavy guitar-based The Man Who Sold the World. But what shocked people the most wasn't the new hard rock sound, but the image on the sleeve.
He sells it by positioning himself on the front cover in a very long, flowing, pre-Raphaelite dress, which was the least macho, least hard rock image imaginable. And it's hard to think now how shocking that actually was.
Susie Bronson.
It wasn't until David and Angela walked down Beckenham High Street, David in a dress and Angela looking remarkably boy-like, that we all started taking notice of him. I mean, people would recoil. I mean, literally, the old girls would literally kind of go, oh, my God, you know. Shocking was what he wanted to be, and shocking was what he was.
The rock scene in 1970 was very much the colour of blue jeans. Everybody wore denim, everybody had long hair, and the music very much reflected that sort of monotoned culture. And I'm sure that's why the album wasn't a hit in this country, was because anybody who was interested in the music picked up the cover and said, no way I'm getting involved in that. This was not an era for men, when men flirted with camp imagery at all.
Three albums in, and Bowie was still failing to find his audience. He desperately needed someone who could turn his undeniable talent into record sales.
Somebody did come along and grab me by the empty wallet and said, I'm Tony DeFries and I'm going to make you a star. I said, oh, yeah.
David was great. Yes, he was. But he hadn't gotten very far until he'd met Tony. He was struggling. Tony had a master plan and things started to happen.
Yeah, you want to be Elvis Presley? I can do that. You know, it can be done, David. It can be done.
He financed it. That was the most important thing. Everything that Bowie did, there was Tony DeFries with the money to pay for it. Without Tony DeFries, we would never have had David Bowie, pop star, rock star at all.
Colour film of New York City in the sunshine.
Tony's main objective was to make Bowie a superstar, and that meant cracking America. So at the beginning of 1971, the 24-year-old singer was sent there on a short promotional tour. Within a few months, he returned, signing a deal with RCA Records in New York, the company who would later fund the Ziggy Stardust project. It was during this period that Bowie was introduced to the subversive world of Andy Warhol and the Velvet Underground. He felt immediately at home, surrounded by New York's counterculture.
We were all working in underground theater, which involved a whole lot of outrageousness. The rock and roll world at the same time in New York was becoming very underground. They were men dressed in women's clothes, but not in drag. They were just wearing women's blouses and things, and a lot of makeup and things. And everything was getting very bizarre.
A party.
Back in London, Bowie continued his fascination with the avant-garde. He hung out in gay nightclubs with a fashion designer called Freddie Beretti. And when an Andy Warhol play called Pork arrived in town, Bowie and his new wife, Angie, befriended the American cast.
We invited Angie and David to come see the play, and they came with Tony DeFries, and we all started to hang out together.
We met David's incredible, loud, crazy wife, Angie, and she was, oh, we have to go do this, we have to go do that, we have to outrage the populace, and we were fine for that.
I was, you know, psychedelic, acid-head hippie chick. In those days, we were still pretty outrageous sexually, I have to say. You know, we had sex in the loos at the Hard Rock Cafe, even with the owners. This was like every night and a lot of people doing it.
Inspired by the outrageous characters he'd met in London and New York, the very beginnings of Ziggy Stardust began to materialise in Bowie's mind. Taking his lead from the star maker Andy Warhol, he invented his own rock and roll star, Arnold Korns.
What he hasn't yet done is to manage to get together the balls to be that rock star himself. And so he chooses somebody who effectively, in musical terms, is a blank canvas.
The idea was to take Freddie Beretti, this beautiful boy that he'd met in the Sombrero Club, and to hand him the songs and dress him up and get him to be Ziggy, even though he would be miming to David's voice.
But he decides that he's going to create a band called Arnold Korns. Now, unfortunately, the music that he's selling is terrible. It's very early versions of some of the songs from Ziggy, and they sound like really rudimentary, very boring and raw demos. But that is really the seed of Ziggy Stardust.
Although Arnold Korns failed, Bowie was convinced the idea of a fictional rock star would work. In the meantime, financial necessity meant Bowie had to submit his songs to a publisher to sell on to other artists. Oh, you pretty things. One such song scored a number 12 hit for the pop star Peter Noon in July 1971. Its strange lyrics were inspired by the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. Doesn't make you wonder, did Peter Noon have any idea what he was singing about? Let me make it plain, you gotta make way for the homo superior. Oh, you pretty things. Bowie's own version, recorded a few months later, revealed the song's compositional brilliance. His songwriting had shifted up a gear, and Oh, You Pretty Things was to be just one classic track on a genius pop album, Hunky Dory.
Listening to the demos over at the house one evening, the light bulb went on at the top of my head. This guy could actually be someone. The talent was coming through. It was so very different from what he'd done in the past, and just, this guy's good.
Ken Scott.
Bowie brought back two of the musicians for The Man Who Sold the World to play on Hunky Dory, guitarist Mick Ronson and drummer Woody Woodmansey. When Bowie was left short of a bass player for a radio session, Mick and Woody suggested their mate from Hull, Trevor Boulder.
Herbie Flowers was supposed to be on it, and Herbie didn't turn up. So I was dragged into learning something like 12 songs or something in an afternoon. Then straight after that, we did Hunky Dory.
Bowie didn't know it yet, but the Spiders from Mars had just formed. He now had in place the musicians who could help him realise his future Ziggy Stardust dream. Hunky Dory also provided the perfect platform for Mick Ronson to really show off his extraordinary musical abilities.
Mick was a very talented musician, apart from being a dynamic guitar player. He was instrumental in arrangements. He'd been classically trained. Is
there life on Mars? A photo of Mick performing with Bowie.
He was one of the great rock musicians in history ever, as an arranger, a piano player as well. I mean, it must have been like having Stravinsky in your band.
Steve Harley, Cockney Rebel.
On its release in November 1971, Hunky Dory was widely praised by the music press in both the UK and America, but with little publicity, it failed to chart.
Bowie's manager was actually very keen that Hunky Dory should not be a success, because if Hunky Dory was a huge album, then it would not be possible for Bowie to transform himself into Ziggy Stardust.
We only had a two-week break between Hunky Dory and starting Ziggy. It was all kind of written and ready to roll, and we just had a break and then went straight into Ziggy.
I said, you've got to be crazy. And he says, management company want me to do another album, and he said, you're not going to like this one. I said, why? And he said, because it's more rock and roll. It's going to be more like, I can't remember if he said Iggy Pop and the Stooges or Velvet Underground. It wouldn't have mattered because I didn't know of either of those acts at that point anyway. Sorry.
The Velvet Underground influence can clearly be heard on Queen Bitch, the one track on Hunky Dory that links the album to Ziggy Stardust. When Bowie performed on BBC's Old Grey Whistle Test in February 1972, he might have played songs from Hunky Dory, but the transformation into his alien alter ego had already started. Well, I'm up on the 11th floor and I'm watching the cruisers below. You know my heart's in the basement, my weekend's at an all-time low. By the time Hunky Dory was completed, Bowie had his Ziggy Stardust album already written. He'd drawn on nearly a decade of experience to create the record that would finally make him famous. And this time, he got it spot on. Ziggy turned Bowie into stardust.
Elton John.
Ziggy Stardust was the thing that really catapulted him into the universe. It's an extraordinary record and it still sounds amazing.
He revolutionised the music business.
It is the greatest record of the 1970s for me.
He's one of my favourite LPs, still.
It lit the blue tucked paper of imagination and creativity for a lot of people.
The album cover features Ziggy outside a building.
The rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars was David Bowie's first hit album, the record that made him a superstar. It tells the story of a doomed alien who takes human form as a rock star.
Mark Almond.
It really always inspired me that it was an album that had a beginning and an end and told a story. It was like a rock opera.
This superstar is killed by his own fans. Rock and roll suicide. He's eaten alive by their energy that he's fed them with. It was a brilliant idea. It was an idea that suited the dystopia of the period.
There'd been economic chaos in the late 60s, and so the Conservatives came in with the idea of sort of battening down the hatches in a short, sharp shock for everybody.
London was extremely poor, and in many ways it was still in the shadow of the Second World War. In 1972, there were bomb sites still everywhere. There was a recession. There was the Cold War as well. And I think what David and Ziggy were offering was a creature of fantasy come to save us. I mean, he sang, "There's only 5 years left of the earth." And actually, in 1972, you did believe there was probably only 5 years.
We've got 5 years stuck on my eyes. 5 years, what a surprise. We've got 5 years, my brain hurts a lot.
The album was made at London's Trident Studios, previously home to recording sessions by the Beatles and Elton John. It was the job of the Spiders from Mars to turn Bowie's demos into rock and roll.
What he used to do for us was play a song on an acoustic guitar and then we'd quickly go through the chords and then we'd play the song, you know.
Trevor and I, and it would be going, is there a chorus next? What comes after that? Does it end on chorus? What, you know? So you've only just got the bare bones of it in your head. And then he's going, OK, let's go for it.
The mixing desk's controls.
You were on the edge, and you knew from experience that he didn't like going more than three takes. You only had three shots, and then, woo, you know, then the... what shall I say? The atmosphere might change.
Woody Woodmansey, The Spiders from Mars. Now, Ken Scott, producer.
As a performer, I haven't come across anyone better. 95% of every vocal I recorded with him was one take from beginning to end. It was amazing.
John Savage, music journalist.
It sounds quite first takey, sounds quite lively and almost improvised. It sounds like a group who's excited to be there. It's not ponderous, it's very light on its feet.
Bowie based the Ziggy character on an eclectic group of his favourite singers, from the early rock and roll of Little Richard to the theatrical chanson of Jacques Brel.
The album was influenced by the Velvet Underground. It was influenced by a lot of early rock and roll, Gene Vincent, Vince Taylor.
Treat me wrong.
Vince Taylor, who was the fatal English rocker, who famously took too much LSD and declared he was Jesus Christ.
I think David took all this in and created this character with an amalgamation of all the bands we've seen. You know, when you think about Scream, Lord Such, he did a great show when he came out of a coffin. And there was Johnny Kidd and the Pirates and all these great bands that were theatrical, you know, did a great theatre as well as rock and roll. And that's what David wanted to do. He wanted to mix it all up, you know.
Another singer who had taken rock and roll theatre to a deranged new level was Iggy Pop, who Bowie had met in New York a few months prior to recording the album.
Iggy was a big influence, and of course Iggy became Ziggy. But no one had gone that extra bit and made their performance a piece of concept art.
Part of that concept was the creation of a new image, so essential to the success of Ziggy Stardust. Bowie began by making the spiders from Mars look like a gang.
He took us to see Clockwork Orange, and that's basically where he got a lot of his ideas for the clothes. You know, we were the drooms.
Freddie Beretti, within a week, had designed the clothes for Ziggy Stardust, the sort of the mock boiler suits from Clockwork Orange.
I always thought they were great because they used curtain fabric from Liberty's, and it was very inventive, those little velvet suits and those great space boots. I mean, they were great. I really liked them.
He called us into his kind of lounge. He had some drawings that he'd done. He said, these are the ideas for what we're going to wear, and we would kind of...
Woody said, I'm fucking wearing that. That was Woody's initial thing.
It took him a while to convince us, especially Mick.
And he'd said to Angie, you won't get me wearing that. Do you know what I mean? I'm a musician, man. I've got friends that are going to watch me, you know?
Also to change was Bowie's long pre-Raphaelite hairstyle.
I said, I think you should cut your hair off because everyone's got long hair. You should do it a different style. Well, that started looking through the magazines as me and Angela David searching through, and we eventually decided on a combination of three different hairstyles. And that was the original Ziggy cut. And the next day I dyed it bright red. And for me, that was the day Ziggy was born.
The first single from the Ziggy Stardust album was Starman, released on the 28th of April 1972. First, it didn't sell. But 2 months later, he appeared on Top of the Pops, and that changed everything. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he blew our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He told us not to blow it. Bowie's wearing a red, yellow and blue jumpsuit. Gary Kemp, Spandau Ballet.
Starman was the eureka moment in rock and roll. This creature appears on Top of the Pops, and he was so shocking, so androgynous, so otherworldly.
It was so different. It was like, wow. And no one had ever seen anything like that before. I had to phone someone, so I
picked on you. Let's not forget David's magic as well. There's a line in it where he sings, I had to phone someone, so I picked on you. And he looked straight down the barrel of the lens, and I was sure he'd picked on me.
He arrived at a time where there was a sort of vacuum in popular music. You had a generation of people who were too young for the 60s, because we were kids. And we were ripe for exploitation. And suddenly there was David Bowie, and we all said, that's what we want.
For any of the older generation who were watching, it probably hadn't escaped their notice that the singer in the multicoloured jumpsuit might not be entirely heterosexual.
Looking at it now, it looks so tame, but at the time, it was a real gesture when he put his arm around the guitarist. It was a very sexual thing.
The arm-draping gesture was even more sexually provocative to readers of The Melody Maker, because Bowie had declared he was gay in the music paper several months earlier.
To go that extra mile and say I'm gay was so outrageous. And of course, gay men at that time weren't characters on soap operas on TV. They weren't outed comedians. It was still seen as being very subversive.
Angela said to him, the shit's hit the fan. And it was the kind of thing a popular singer didn't say, whether it was true or whether it wasn't in those days. Angela also said to him, well, look, you know, you might at least have said I'm bisexual.
The magazine article's headed, Oh You Pretty Thing.
No one had paid any attention when Bowie hung around the gay scene with Lindsay Kemp several years earlier. But after the Top of the Pops performance had made him a household name, his sexual orientation became a national talking point.
Bowie probably did make homosexuality fashionable. Don't forget, it's not somebody who's a bit naff saying I'm gay and nobody cares. It's somebody who's super hip.
At that time, people were feeling so repressed and it was dangerous and they were getting beat up, so he liberated a lot of people. I thought he was doing a really good thing.
Whether he was gay or bisexual, at this point in time, Bowie was married with a son, and so the ambiguity gained him a huge amount of press attention. It also seemed to make him even more attractive to women.
David Bowie is hot. He's gorgeous. Yes, androgynous. Oh, gorgeous. Physically striking.
I just wanted to have sex with him. I didn't want him to be gay.
Performing on Top of the Pops gave Bowie the power to unleash Ziggy Stardust to 15 million people in just 3 minutes. The single was soon on its way to number 10 in the charts, Bowie's first hit since Space Oddity 3 years earlier.
Bowie mania happened immediately. You'd go to school, and in, I would say, 3 days, people had the haircut.
When you see big, fat, hairy truckers with short, Ziggy haircuts, it's quite a revelation. Oh, my goodness me, you know?
To go out to the shop, you had to go out the back garden and climb over a wall and sort of disguise yourself and then walk down an alleyway, because the street was just covered in kids. There was kids everywhere.
We went out shopping, and we came back with all our shopping, and we hadn't spent a penny.
And Bowie's is even worse. I know there'd be like at least 100 kids out there all the time waiting to see him.
When the album smashed into the top five, Bowie knew the ghost of the one-hit wonder had finally been laid to rest. After a decade of attempts, he'd finally cracked it.
Colour film of a band on stage.
The success of Ziggy Stardust coincided with the emerging glam rock scene, but Bowie was more interested in creating his own super hip clique. The first part of this plan was to donate a song to the much-loved but struggling Motley Hoople. It became an even bigger hit than Starman. Steve Harvey, Cockney Rebel.
You grew to hate him, Bowie. Not only was he writing all his own and making all these, he's revived Mott the Hoople's career from a funeral pyre, you know, Pegasus here. And he wrote this great, great song that will live forever.
Next, he turned his attention to two of the artists who had been a huge influence on his music for Ziggy. The first was Velvet Underground's Lou Reed.
The brilliant thing about his friendship with Lou Reed is that Lou Reed was successful before he came along. I mean, the Velvet Underground, the most influential group of all time. Yet, come here, I'll take you under my wing. I'm going to turn you, Lou Reed, into a pop star in the UK. Really clever. Hey, babe, take a walk on the
wild side. In the summer of 1972, alongside Mick Ronson, Bowie produced Lou Reed's Transformer album. It's still Lou's most successful album to date. A few months later, Bowie was at the mixing desk for Iggy Pop and the Stooges' Raw Power.
The young Iggy Pop.
Today it's considered as a massive inspiration for the punk rock movement.
We'd never heard of Iggy Pop, we'd never heard of Lou Reed. Bowie revealed those to us. They become part of Bowie's coterie, so we wanted to listen to them.
A black and white shot of Iggy and Bowie laughing.
I can't stand the premise of going on in jeans and being real. I mean, it's not normal.
Adoring fans singing along at a gig.
The first Ziggy Stardust tour had started back in February with little commotion, but after Top of the Pops, the dates began to sell out. Bowie's chemistry with guitarist Mick Ronson was evolving into one of rock's great partnerships.
If you really want to know what the sound of Ziggy Stardust is, apart from David Bowie's voice, it's Mick Ronson's guitar. It just felt like an animal begging to be released whenever he played.
Trevor Boulder, bass player.
He was a brilliant guitar player. He wasn't one of these technically fast players, but he played beautiful guitar. His melody work was just so good. I mean, Moon Age Daydream, you listen to the end of Moon Age Daydream, the solo on the end of that. He's simple but genius.
For me, he was the best guitarist around in those days. I mean, he was the guitarist to have, and he contributed so much, because he looked great too. They made a great couple.
You see those two on stage, it was exciting. David going down on Mick's guitar. Revelation. When my mother saw that paper, she came home and she threw it on the table. She said, "Is this who you're working for?" I said, "Oh, they're just pretending, Mum."
For some reason, he just did things like that, you know. And of course, somebody took a picture of it, and the next thing it's in the press, and it's supposed to be sexual and God knows what else, you know.
The final dates of the UK tour in August were at London's Rainbow Theatre. Bowie would be performing in front of some of the biggest names in pop and was keen to show he'd come on a long way since Space Oddity. Helping Bowie change the show from a rock gig into a theatrical spectacle was his old dance tutor, Lindsay Kemp.
David was fascinated by what I had to teach him, what I had to tell him about the kabuki. Kabuki is that wonderful Japanese theatre where men play the female roles, and of course they move in a very stylized way. Music is a very important part of the spectacle, and spectacle it is.
Black and white film of dancers in patterned costumes.
It was the first time a pop star had combined rock music with exotic costumes, theatrical lighting, choreography, and mime. It certainly had the desired effect.
When he came out as Ziggy Stardust, it was like an art installation. It was like, wow. His stage presence is quite extraordinary. David was so glamorous and so beautiful and androgynous and sexual.
David as Ziggy commanded the stage. You just wanted to be him. You adored him.
Quite honestly, I'd never seen anything like it in my life. It was so exciting.
For manager Tony DeFries, breaking Ziggy in Britain was the easy part. Cracking America would be a whole different ballgame. Even though he'd signed to RCA the previous year, the record label hadn't raised Bowie's US profile at all. Tony's plan was to open an office in New York and use RCA's money to pretend David was already huge in America, just as Bowie had pretended with Ziggy. Some old Warhol friends were drafted in to help.
He had two bodyguards, and he dressed the bodyguards up in karate costumes, and they flanked him wherever he went. Everyone assumed then that he was just as big as Mick Jagger and Elton John, and of course he wasn't. We were having to create this myth.
We all had 24-hour limos, you know, first-class tickets and aeroplanes, everything paid for around the world. It was just madness.
Tony was good at telling them, I need that much money and we're going to do it like this. You're going to do that, this, that and that. And phew.
They were afraid of us. We're all in makeup, they can't tell the men from the women. All they wanted to do was when we would be sitting in their offices making outrageous demands, they just wanted to get us out of their offices. And so they'd just say yes to anything.
The house lights were about to go down for the appearance of David Bowie.
A 28-day US tour was booked, kicking off in September. One of the standout gigs was at Santa Monica. A bootleg recording of the concert immortalised the raw power of the Spiders from Mars.
All of a sudden, strobe lights were going and everything was bright and just blew people's minds. Hey,
Rodney Bingenheimer, radio DJ and promoter.
Everybody's on the phone saying, you gotta see this new show, David Bowie. You know, he's something else, you know, and people couldn't believe it. It was just so different.
And I remember David saying he thought the audience weren't responding very much. And I said, David, you've got to remember, they're staring at you with their mouth open. They haven't quite worked out where you're from, you know, another planet or something, you know.
The tour featured one addition to the Spiders, who would be instrumental in changing the sound of future David Bowie records, Mike Garson. The keyboardist came from a completely different musical background.
It was a big shock coming from jazz, very loose kind of playing, but I realized they had a vibe that was very, very cool. So I just found a way to lock into it, and they were very accepting.
While Bowie had impressed auditorium audiences near the East and West Coasts, when the tour progressed through the more conservative states of America, the reception wasn't quite so warm.
Nobody wants to go and see this guy who says he's gay and is playing these strange songs and is wearing makeup. They want a boogie, you know, they want people in denim with long hair who look like them. And so he's playing arenas across America, and some nights he's getting 200 or 300 people along.
City lights at night.
Despite some poor attendances, the management continued to circulate the idea that Bowie was a huge celebrity. But their luxury living was on borrowed money.
By the time we got to Hollywood, they put us in the Chateau Marmont, which you don't get any better than the Chateau Marmont, really, in Hollywood. But no, I'm on the phone, and I said, no, this won't do. We have to stay in the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Room service for 1 week was about $12,000. Was it more than that? It might have been more. I don't know. That was just me.
Everything we wanted, we just signed for. Well, I think we spent $40,000 or something like that. And I don't know what we spent it on, but it went.
and we stayed there for 6 weeks. Not only the whole band, but all the roadies, all the everybody. Iggy was there, Serinda Fox was there, all on RCA's money, and by this time RCA was so far in debt that they couldn't get out of it.
It sounds really, you know, hippy-dippy, but it just worked beautifully. It really did.
Cherry Vanilla, publicist.
This fantasy lifestyle gave the Spiders the impression they were going to be very rich. A chance conversation between drummer Woody and new boy Mike Garson put an end to that theory.
I was sitting on an aeroplane with him, and I was reading a magazine, and there was a Lamborghini in it. And I went, ooh, that's nice. And he went, why don't you buy one? And I went, yeah, I wish. And he went, well, you must be able to afford one. And I went, well, actually, no.
I was getting a salary, and it seemed fair. And I just assumed the other guys were getting more because they were there several years.
I went, what do you think I get, you know? And he went, well, I know what I get. And I went, so what do you get? And he told me, and it was like three times what I got.
We went to Bowie and said, look, you know, unless things change and you give us some money, we're going home.
Kind of the final straw was really De Vries saying to us, I would rather pay the road crew more than you, right? And I just went, there's no game here.
The Spiders eventually renegotiated their contracts, but the whole saga tainted their relationship with Bowie. As the tour continued around America, the news coming out of Britain was that glam rock had exploded. The previous year, Mark Bolan had been the leader of the scene, having choked up four number one singles. By 1973, the balance of power was shifting.
Bolan opened the door for the whole glam rock thing, and Bowie just took it completely somewhere else and turned it into kind of like an art form. And Roxy Music, of course, were part of that as well. They, again, were very original, in this sci-fi and 50s glam mix. I think the whole three of those together were the real kind of core of what glam rock was about. Everything else was just something that came in on the bandwagon. When you saw bands like The Sweet, who were kind of had that great kind of 70s lorry drivers dressed in drag kind of feeling.
There's a couple of quite good records as pure records, but they were not that interesting. My brain was full up with Baudelaire and Byron and Shelley and all these, you know, lunatic poets, artists, and Gary Glitter and Slade, you know, I couldn't see any link there. Whereas with David, you could see a clear link in the sophistication of what they were doing.
Nick Rock, photographer.
In January 1973, Bowie returned to Britain as glam rock's leading light, performing a brand new song on Top of the Pops.
Peter Hook, musician.
Something about that rock attitude and that blurring of sexuality that is very, very alluring to young people, especially teenagers, with the confusion of growing up.
I think there was a very sort of urban, working-class, male-dominated love of the Ziggy look, because who was going to argue with a bloke who looked like that, who was pretty tough?
You were taking your life in your hands to wear mascara to school in Liverpool in 1973 or dyeing your hair bright red, you know. My parents were horrified. You know, what have I done to deserve this walking freak show for a son, you know?
Aladdin was more in the area of Ziggy Goes to America. Here was this alternative world that I'd been talking about. And it had all the violence and all the strangeness, and it was really happening. It wasn't just in my songs.
Let me put my arms around your head. Gee, it's hot. Let's go to bed.
Don't forget. Ziggy and the Spiders' next TV appearance was on The Russell Harty Show, performing another new track. Drive-In Saturday was taken from Bowie's next album, Aladdin Sane, which had been almost entirely written and recorded in the USA. It's the perfect example of how Bowie's American experience influenced his songwriting.
You could feel him absorbing it. Many times I was in the limo with him and he'd be working on the music, working on lyrics, listening to great American music. But I never expected the album to come out so soon. It just shows his prolificness.
I think that's the genius of David. He could write and play and travel all at the same time. It did feel still like Ziggy, but it was a much more exotic album.
I always think of Aladdin Sane as Ziggy Stardust on tour, and these are my postcards home. And this is what I've seen when I've been out there. The madness, the wild excesses of America. He can see the glamour, but he can see the horror underneath as well.
A topless woman dancing. No, driving by shop windows at night.
Bowie took ideas from everywhere, something he's done throughout his career.
He called me in to listen to some songs. I said, that's a Jane County lyric. You know, and he said, oh, yes, isn't it nice? And I said, oh, David, it's not yours, it's Jane's. And he said, well, no, he said, everything I get is from someone else. What I do is I know which things to steal.
He's an incredible magpie. And a lot of people think that's a huge negative because he cherry-picks. He cherry-picks ideas, people, clothes, everything. But I think it's extraordinarily clever.
Bowie had seen something he could cherry-pick from Mike Garson. The session musician had been brought in to play keyboards on the first American tour, and Bowie thought his jazz background would be perfect for Aladdin Sane.
For me, Mike Garson's piano was what lifted that above anything anyone else was doing at that time, made it exotic, made it decadent.
Musicians like Garson will play jazz stuff that isn't written on the chord sheet for the song. Garson's playing is eccentric and wild and beautiful at the same time.
They showed me songs like, for example, Time. You know, David was looking for something that was from the 1920s, but twisted, like he does with his song. So I go... you know, something like that. Or Lady Grinning Soul, he wanted this more romantic thing, so...
By February 1973, Aladdin Sane was completed and Bowie was straight back into another American tour. In the space of just 18 months, he'd released three of his greatest albums, played two extensive tours, and was about to embark on a new live schedule that involved nearly 100 gigs.
Bowie crouching on stage with his left leg outstretched. Trevor Boulder, bass player.
It was a tough tour because we were doing two shows a night. And we considered that David had to do all the interviews, had to do all the press, had to do everything else, and then go out and perform and do that. That must have been really hard for him. I don't think he was particularly healthy by the end of that tour, you know.
His entourage were getting very concerned about his physical health because he wasn't eating properly, he wasn't sleeping. Bowie said of that period he couldn't stand the noise of the band ringing in his ears, you know, whether he was on stage or not.
I wasn't getting rid of him at all. In fact, I was joining forces with him. The doppelganger and myself were starting to become one and the same person. And then you start on this trail of chaotic psychological destruction, you know, and you become what's called a drug casualty at the end of it all.
Woody.
When it really hit big and people wanted interviews, they didn't want to talk to David Bowie. They wanted to talk to Ziggy Stardust. And you could see the struggle.
Bowie is giving interviews saying, I seem to have created this monster and it's taking me over and I don't really know who I am anymore.
It was always Ziggy. So even when you were in the car, you kind of had Ziggy with you.
After 2 months in America, the tour moved to Japan. There was already a big buzz surrounding Ziggy's arrival because of his use of kabuki makeup and clothes. Bowie also wore outfits created by the country's leading fashion designer, Kansai Yamamoto. When the tour came to Tokyo, Kansai presented Bowie with a whole load of specially designed Ziggy regalia. In the BBC documentary Cracked Actor, filmed a year later in 1974, Bowie explained their significance.
Aladdin Sane was a schizophrenic that's accounted for lots of the... why there were so many costume changes, because he had so many personalities that each, as far as I was concerned, each costume change was a different facet of personality.
Released in April 1973, Aladdin Sane went straight to the top of the UK charts. It was Bowie's first number one record, and it wasn't long before all his previous albums charted too. The next month, the momentous tour rolled into Britain for its final stretch.
I'd said all I could say about Ziggy, and I thought, well, I'm very tempted to go further with this Ziggy thing only because it's so popular, but actually it's not what I really want to do. And then I've created this bloody thing. How do I sort of get out of it?
The extensive UK tour drew in hordes of teenage Ziggies, many desperate to see their idol in the flesh. 60 performances in 53 days, and every ticket sold. Come on, come on.
Nick Garson.
The audiences were screaming. People jumping off the rafters, and you saw people getting knocked down, coming on stage by the bodyguards. The level of enthusiasm and the joy of the audience was more honest and deeper than the U.S.
Mark Arnold.
Being there at the front, I just remember being lost in the whole kind of emotion of the whole thing, you know. It was incredibly powerful, and I'd never seen a band like that before. You really kind of wanted to be a part of it. It was part of belonging to something as well, wanting to be part of a culture, part of a gang.
We used to run David off and get him in the car, get the band in the car. Within a couple of months, it was a mob scene. It was the same, it was like the Beatles, you know, there we were, and people were climbing on the car.
It wasn't just the fans that were struggling to catch a glimpse of Britain's biggest star.
In fact, the last tour we ever did with him, we'd only see him on stage. We'd walk on stage, we'd play the show, he'd get in his limousine and clear off, and we'd all go back to the hotel, and we'd see him the next day on stage again. We thought it was odd. We'd started out as a band. Really, that's what he wanted, was a band. And then the bigger and bigger it got, the less we saw of him.
The tour was set for a triumphant end at the Hammersmith Odeon. The whole event was filmed by documentary maker D.A. Pennybaker, who had been commissioned by Bowie's record label to capture history in the making. The BBC was there too, filming for the Nationwide Current Affairs programme.
What's it like with all these girls loving your husband so much?
Absolutely fabulous. Wouldn't you love to be loved by so many?
Nearly a decade after he had started on his quest for fame, David Bowie was the most famous pop star in Britain. Among the excited Ziggy clones queuing outside, celebrities arrived to catch the conquering hero at his homecoming gig.
Can I ask you why you've come to see David Bowie?
Well, he's a fine performer, isn't he?
As usual, he went through his extravagant pre-show preparations. Everything was set for an electric performance, and Bowie delivered with cool composure.
He performs under a red spotlight.
Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars were playing the concert of their lives. Both the band and the audience were high on the energy buzzing around the venue. Backstage was buzzing too, with the rumour of a special announcement.
Just before we went on stage, David came round to me and he said, "Don't start Rock and Roll Suicide until I give you the nod."
It was decided in Japan. Mick was sworn to secrecy, and if you do this for us, you're going to be the next star, you're going to be doing this next thing, but you can't tell the boys.
Just before the final song, David Bowie approached the microphone and with a few words, broke the hearts of millions.
Of all the shows on this tour,
this particular show will remain with us the longest, because not only is it the last show of the tour, but it's the last show that we'll ever do. Thank you.
We all went, oh, what the fuck's it all about? quite shocked. And I kept looking at Woody, and Woody was like playing away going, I don't know what's going on, you know.
It didn't quite equate with what we'd been talking about 3 days earlier. So we didn't know whether that was true or not.
Everybody knew except for Woody and Trevor. I knew. Sound guy knew. I think that was horrific to have done that to them.
It was not a big deal to me, but to the other guys, they thought it certainly could have gone on for another 5 or 10 years, but David was done with it. And any artist at any time is entitled to be done with something.
Those people who are lead singers and stand alone, they have to. They have to change, you know, they can't do the same show every time. So in other words, it could be calculated, but it's brilliant calculation because not many people would have the wits or the knowledge or the intelligence to do that.
Nearly a year to the day after he appeared on Top of the Pops for the first time, Ziggy Stardust was over. Just as Bowie had prophesied on Rock and Roll Suicide, the final song on the Ziggy album. Art had become life, life had imitated art.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye, we love you.
I said I'm going back to big heavy melodrama, and you don't fit into my scheme of things. And I finished it. A cruel and cutting blow. But it had to be done. Sometimes you've got to be cruel to be kind.
A headline says, Bowie quits.
Less than a week after Ziggy's dramatic retirement, Bowie was in France recording a new album, Pin-Ups. But it was more of a stopgap. No original songs, just a collection of covers. Drummer Woody wasn't even invited to the studio sessions. Soon Bowie had dropped the Spiders completely.
The safe thing to do would have been to keep being Ziggy for the rest of his career. But he had the courage that very, very few pop stars have ever had to take the thing which is most loved and say, I'm not doing that anymore.
The rest of the decade saw Bowie in a creative frenzy, producing 7 groundbreaking albums in just as many years. He was to the 70s what the Beatles were to the 60s. Despite devising more characters over those years, Bowie struggled to exorcise the ghost of Ziggy Stardust. In the immediate aftermath of the alien's demise, Bowie sank into a dangerous drug addiction, battling to leave the past behind.
I had a kind of strange psychosomatic death wish thing, I think. But that's because I was so lost in Ziggy, I think, again. It was all that schizophrenia. And he really grew, sort of out of proportion, I suppose. Got much bigger than I thought Ziggy was going to be. I didn't ever see Ziggy as big. Ziggy just overshadowed everything.
David Bowie's incredible career spans over 40 years. But for many, it's Ziggy Stardust for which he'll be best remembered.
It's so iconic. You can track pop culture from that very point, and it all leads back to Ziggy Stardust.
We all wanted to know what he was wearing, what he was singing about, what his videos were like, because he was the leader of the artistic side of rock and roll.
You look at punk, and basically they're more monochromatic, more aggressive versions of the Ziggy construct.
80s music wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for Bowie. When it came to be our turn in 1979, dressing up was where we started. Makeup was where we started.
Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, in a way, were the blueprint for Frankie Goes to Hollywood in a kind of lock up your daughters and your sons sense. And anyone who challenges the Moors of today are doing a Ziggy, in a sense. You know, it went through to the 90s with Suede and Pulp.
Its tentacles reach out and are still being taken on board today. I mean, if you look at someone like Lady Gaga, her whole act, it's Bowie, it's Ziggy Stardust. OK, she's put a 21st century slant on it, but she's not really doing anything that Bowie didn't do 40 years ago.
I'm very happy with Ziggy. I think he was a very successful character, and I think I played him very well. But I'm glad I'm me now.